tuned to Tidings, and I'm Hazel Kahn, and I'm very pleased to have Dr. Alice Rothschild as my guest today. Welcome, Alice, again, after many years to this program. Alice is a tireless activist. She's a Boston-based obstetrician, filmmaker, and social justice activist. Her films include the documentary Voices Across the Divide. Alice is talking to us via Skype from Seattle. Today, however, we'll be talking to the Jewish Alice, if that doesn't sound too odd. Is that too odd to say that?
I think so, because my interest in listening to Palestinian voices comes from a very Jewish place. So I don't feel at all segregated in my identities. So I wouldn't characterize myself that way because I'm always a Jewish person. Mm-hmm. And I do this work mostly in what I feel is more a prophetic tradition. I'm not a religious Jew, but I take my cultural history very seriously. So I'm in the Search for Justice Jewish persuasion, and that includes listening to voices of dissent in Israel and listening to Palestinian voices.
So when you say the prophetic tradition, could you explain that to our listeners?
Well, my understanding of the prophetic tradition is that there is a whole collection of writings and philosophy and statements from ancient Jewish prophets who are concerned with issues of justice. And so it's a very straightforward way of looking at the world, which is that you listen to people who are oppressed and you work to reduce injustice in the world. And you don't find things that would be unacceptable for you acceptable for someone else. So that's sort of, in a nutshell, what I mean by working in the prophetic tradition.
I see in some of you, the early part in this article you wrote that is called Zionism's Uneasy Relationship with Antisemitism, that was published on November 19th in Mondo Weiss. You start by talking about how you came to Israel as a young woman, young girl, and you were smitten by Israel. You were smitten with a deep love for Israel, and then that transformed as the decades passed, you said, the mythology of what you thought Israel was had been shattered against the hard rocks of reality. Could you talk about that?
I was born in 1948, so I always feel like, well, here's a country that's the same age as me. My mother came from an Orthodox Jewish tradition. My father was more secular, but they were both in the progressive Jewish Zionist camp. So I, you know, went to Hebrew school. I went to Israel when I was 14, and I still have the diary that I kept at that point. So it was a very magical place. I loved Israeli folk dancing and Israeli jewelry. And so I was very smitten is the right word with the country. And that was part of inheritance from my family that, you know, we had come out of the Holocaust and this state had risen out of the ashes. There were all these wonderful kibbutzim and sort of socialist leanings. And this was all very, very attractive. And the thing that I find interesting is that particularly for my mother, who was a fairly critical thinker on a lot of other things, there was no critical thinking in Israel. So my parents were very involved in supporting Israeli institutions. My mother was a writer, and she did work in Israel. My father worked with the Chamber of Commerce in Israel. He worked at the Weizmann Institute. I mean, there were a lot of connections. Mm-hmm. And it was just a country that we loved and supported. And so that's where I started from. And, you know, when I hit college and started thinking more independently, I became much more aware of my attitudes toward Arabs, which, first of all, I'd never met an Arab, so it was very easy to have all these attitudes. As I became more involved in reading about colonialism and racism and imperialism, and, you know, really beginning to understand how the world works in a way that was not the kind of world that was, you know, taught in my public school education, I started having to apply this analysis to Israel, and things started falling apart. But it was a very difficult decades because no one in my circles knew how to talk about this. No one knew any Arabs or Palestinians. And, you know, there was a lot of other things going on. I was going to medical school. I was raising a family. Yeah, it was like there was a lot happening. And if we tried to engage in conversations about Israel or Israeli politics, it just ended up with everybody yelling at each other. So there was no impetus to try to work on this. I felt like I had this inconsistency in my understanding. So in the 1990s, I got together with a group of similarly sort of agonized secular Jewish people who were politically progressive, but hadn't really explored the whole Israel dynamic, but felt uncomfortable. And we started a dialogue group, and we started meeting with Palestinians in the Boston area, as well as dissenting Israelis. And that was my first exposure to a whole other narrative, to a whole experience of history that I knew nothing about. And as I explored that, everything became much more clear and much more understandable. And I really began to be sort of obsessed with this. So I got involved with a group that was organizing delegations to Israel and to Palestine, to the West Bank and Gaza and East Jerusalem. And, you know, the more I went, the more contradictions I saw and the more I understood. And so that was sort of my trajectory. And it has led to where I am now, which is that I'm basically doing writing and analysis, adult things, children's books, all sorts of things. I'm trying to explore this stuff and to share it with other people.
Are you expressing the empathy with people who are still conflicted about being Jewish and pro-Palestinian?
Since I was once one of those people, I need to help people walk along the journey. So I'm trying to find creative ways to do that. And some of that is by, you know, writing articles like Zionism's Uneasy Relationship to Anti-Semitism, which is not a usual thing for people to be talking about. It's also by doing a lot of public speaking. I'm looking for a publisher for a middle grade novel I wrote, and I'm now writing a young adult novel. So I'm trying to figure out how can I have these kinds of empathic, though critical, discussions with people who either know nothing or who are totally torn and ambivalent. And what I find is that the younger the person, the less ambivalent they are, and the more open to thinking about what I'm saying without having a nervous breakdown. So that makes it a very interesting discourse.
It is a very painful place, and I think there are a lot of people, including myself, by the way, who have gone through that transition. It is a transition.
Right.
You know, and even today, there's always this little niggling thing somewhere. I don't know if it will ever be 100% resolved.
Well, no. I mean, there's a huge amount of emotion and trauma that goes into this particular worldview and the inability to move to a different worldview. And I have a tremendous respect for trauma. You're right. It is a tough issue for many people. It's also a tough issue once you sort of make the leap and think, wait a minute, I was sold, you know, a story that is not exactly true. How do I, you know, do reparations for that in some way? So it's painful on both sides. I mean, every time I go to the region, you know, I come home with my own little private PTSD because I cannot stand what I'm seeing. And so, you know, there's trauma on all sides here. And I'm a privileged white lady. I'm not even one of the traumatized groups. So it's a complicated position to be in.
But it's one that more and more people are examining, I would say.
Absolutely. And that's why there's this sort of panic within the mainstream Jewish community and this equating criticism of Israeli policy with anti-Semitism, because there's a massive, you know, multi-billion dollar funded through Israel and the U.S. and various other countries to fight all this criticism and all this thoughtful discussion, and particularly focused around the boycott, divestment and sanction movement, which defenders of Israeli policy find particularly threatening. And it must be that it's particularly effective if they find it particularly threatening. I think the main thing that Israel has is its reputation, and attempts to change that reputation is experienced as very threatening.
That's the other story. And we're not going to actually talk about that, even though that's what we've been talking about. So that's the background. And that's sort of what I thought at first, that's what you would be writing about. But in fact, you're writing about something very different. It's very complex, and I'd like to make some kind of transition from what the rest of the Jewish world, let's say, progressive world, is going through in terms of a transition or in terms of the contradiction and the conflicts, the internal ones. I'd like to make a transition from that to this origin story that you tell in your article. I have seen and heard some of those things, but I think for many people who are listening today, it's going to be very shocking what you're going to tell them. So I'm going to leave it up to you to talk about what this origin story is and how it's playing out today.
You know, I always knew that, you know, the new Jew, the Israeli Hebrew muscular farmer, teller, warrior type, was supposed to be this transformative thing for Jews from coming from oppressive Eastern Europe. But I'd never really put it all together until I started researching this topic. And what became clear is that in the late, you know, 1897 kind of time, when modern Zionism was born, there was a real adoption of the idea that the diaspora Jew, you know, the Torah scholar, the pale, flaccid, yeshiva bacha type Jew, who was described as an alien, a parasite, that Zionism really embraced the idea that this kind of pathetic little person needed to be transformed. And as I looked at what they were transforming, it was clear to me that pathetic Torah scholar Jew was actually being Aryanized. It was extolling, you know, the bronzed warrior, tiller of the soil type person. And that was really chilling for me, because in some ways, you know, now that we understand, for instance, institutional racism, there was a way that the early Zionists were adopting the tropes of the anti-Semites around which they lived. And that was extremely disturbing for me. You know, it was complicated by the fact that European Jews were only allowed to do certain professions, and they were, you know, bankers, and they had this whole peddler merchant class thing going on. So there's a lot of other things going on as modern capitalism developed. But there was this sense in the Jewish community that Jews were lacking, and that what they needed to do was to be cured by working the land of Palestine and claiming the land of Palestine. And that is actually a fairly anti-Semitic stand. Mm-hmm. So I was like, oh my goodness, there is some weird relationship between Zionism and anti-Semitism. And what I learned is that Herzl and the early Zionists looked at anti-Semites as their allies, because Herzl wanted Jews to all emigrate to Palestine and create, you know, an ethnically pure Jewish state. And anti-Semites wanted Jews all to leave and get out of their way. So they actually had a shared goal, which was to get Jews to leave the country. I don't know whether this kind of political solidarity was conscious, where it came from, but it clearly was part of the deal.
It's almost an extreme example of politics making strange bedfellows.
Yes.
And, you know, when I read things that you wrote in this article, I was wondering, can we really say these things on this program, or will people just not understand? Do they understand this trope of the weak, pale Jew wearing black and always praying, right, or
the Shakespeare Jew?
Yeah. I just want to make sure that that is clear to our audiences. And that was, of course, exacerbated during the Nazis. I mean, they were.
But there was sort of a buy-in by Zionists of that trope, which is really, really disturbing.
Yes.
And I think that part of learning from history is being painfully honest about what it's about, because that's the only way we can figure out how we got where we got and how to change where we're going. So that's why I thought it was important to really delve into this stuff and think about it. You know, the other big mover and shaker was Jabotinsky, who was the founder of revisionist Zionism. And he was basically a fascist. I mean, he liked Hitler, he liked Mussolini. And his writings about Jews in Eastern Europe were really profoundly anti-Semitic. I mean, he talks about the Yid, which is the Yiddish word for Jew, in a totally derogatory way, and how you have to shed that and become the new Hebrew in Palestine. That kind of attitude is really a kind of self-hatred, and is also an incredibly disturbing piece of this whole history, because it's all wound into his fascism and his flirting with Mussolini, and he created fascistic organizations that then grew into the Likud party. So it's not like the Likud party just popped up out of nowhere. It has an origin story that we have to pay attention to, and that helps us to understand where attitudes that we now see in Israel today have come from.
Dr. Alice Rothschild is talking about Israel's origin story. This is Tidings on WPKN Radio. I would like our audience to hear something that Herzl in Der Judenstaat published in 1896. Could you read that?
In his book Der Judenstaat, published in 1896, Herzl explains why the Jewish question exists wherever Jews live in perceptible numbers. where it, in other words, anti-Semitism, does not exist, it is carried by Jews in the course of their migration. We naturally move to those places where we are not persecuted, and there our presence produces persecution. The unfortunate Jews are now carrying the seeds of anti-Semitism into England. They have already introduced it into America.
Oh, then we also have Chaim Weizmann.
I write, and another damning piece of evidence is the 1912 comment by Chaim Weizmann, later president of the World Zionist Organization and first president of Israel, quote, "Each country can absorb only a limited number of Jews if she doesn't want disorders in her stomach. Germany already has too many Jews." I mean, that's shocking that a Jewish person would say that, you know, but that's part of the history.
And then Ben-Gurion.
Yeah, Ben-Gurion, I have a quote from him, where Israel's founding father and first prime minister, Ben-Gurion, in 1922 wrote, "We are not yeshiva students debating the fine points of self-improvement. We are conquerors of the land facing a wall of iron, and we have to break through it." I mean, this is the whole developing of a militarized state that is designed to cleanse the region of non-Jews and build this Jewish state, and it comes from somewhere, and this is part of where it comes. And Ben-Gurion was very disdainful of diaspora Jews. I mean, he called them human dust. He thought Yemeni Jews were backward and dangerous and primitive to the state, and they had to be transformed basically into Europeans. I mean, he was very racist in his ideology, and it's all there. I mean, it's not a subtle finding, you know. I think the most disturbing thing that Jabotinsky said was this paragraph about the typical Yid, which I just cringe when I read it. This is Jabotinsky, quote, "Our starting point is to take the typical Yid of today and to imagine his diametrical opposite. Because the Yid is ugly, sickly, and lacks decorum. We shall endow the ideal image of the Hebrew with masculine beauty. The Yid is trodden upon and easily frightened, and therefore the Hebrew ought to be proud and independent. The Yid is despised by all, and therefore the Hebrew ought to charm all. The Yid has accepted submission, and therefore the Hebrew ought to learn how to command. The Yid wants to conceal his identity from strangers, and therefore the Hebrew should look the world straight in the eye and declare, I am a Hebrew."
In other words, the sickly, pathetic Jew has to be transformed in Palestine. The Palestine is the sufficient and necessary condition for this transformation to take place. It can't happen anywhere else in the world.
Right.
So these are the roots of the Jewish settlement of Israel.
Complicated also because there's a huge amount of real anti-Semitism in Eastern Europe, and Jews are fleeing pogroms and a huge amount of oppression, flee to Palestine.
So when they came to Palestine in the 1920s, how did these roots and these beginnings get carried over into the establishment of the State of Israel?
I don't want to make major generalizations, but I think some of the themes of the people who emigrated to Palestine included a hatred of Arabs, and a total lack of desire to live with people. So I think that the main goal of the Zionist movement was based and grounded in Jewish privilege, whether you thought it was from the Torah or whether you thought it was from something else, that Jews were going to dominate this land. So that when people made Aliyah, they didn't come to live amongst the Arab population. They came to claim land for themselves. So it became a battle over land and power. And that continues to this day. And the idea that Jews and Jewish trauma and Jewish yearnings and Jewish history are privileged over the indigenous population exists today. So those themes are carried up till 2019. And also a sort of fundamental racism towards Arabs is consistent with Israeli policy, even Jewish Arabs, so that it was a very much Eurocentric, white-dominated political elite, and that still rings true in Israel today. There are these kinds of historical themes that I think are currently present, as well as a willingness to make alliances with groups or people that are clearly the enemy. So, why is Israel snuggling up to Saudi Arabia? Or why do Israelis love Trump? Christian Zionists who are pouring huge amounts of money into the settler movement, you know, the Christian Zionist plan is that we Jews all go back and then we die. I mean, that just doesn't sound like a good plan to me. But if you're willing to snuggle up with a Nazi, then you're willing to snuggle up with someone who hopes that you die in hell. You know, it's a similar willingness to cavort with the enemy, I think.
To cavort with the enemy, there's this willingness. And that needs to be analyzed further, but maybe this is not the place to do that. We can bring in self-hatred here.
Right, right. You know, in my article, I call it a toxic masculinity. There is a stance that the world is against us and we're going to power our way through and God help anyone who stands in our way. And I think that that has a long history as well. And that explains a lot of what's happening in Israel and Palestine now, as well as the racism towards the other, a country that has ministers that call Arabs cockroaches or killing people in Gaza, mowing the lawn. I mean, that's appalling. And if you perceive that every Gazan is the enemy and out to kill you, that's a kind of attitude that is grounded in history, is grounded in the fact that oppressed people will arise against their oppressors. It's grounded in the fact that colonized people don't say to the colonizer, sure, take my land, it's fine.
You quote Amy Kaplan. Please talk about that because it's so odd.
There was a book that came out in 2018 by Amy Kaplan. It's called Our American Israel. This was actually the book that made me want to look back at all of this history. She noted that after the war ended, even non-Jews thought that the children of the Eastern European Jewish race were magically transformed, anglicized by the experience of being born in Palestine. Bartley Crum was a San Francisco-born liberal Catholic civil rights attorney who was part of the Anglo-American Committee charged with determining the future of displaced persons languishing in camps post-war. Kaplan noted, quote, Crum found evidence for this transformation of Eastern European Jews in a strange phenomenon that made their offspring raised in Palestine not only stronger from working the land, but also whiter and more Western than their parents. Many of the Jewish children I saw were blonde and blue-eyed, a mass mutation that, I was told, is yet to be adequately explained. It is the more remarkable because the majority of the Jews of Palestine are of East European stock, traditionally dark-haired and dark-eyed. One might almost assert that a new Jewish folk is being created in Palestine, the vast majority almost a head taller than their parents, a sturdy people more a throwback to the farmers and fishermen of Jesus' day than products of the sons and daughters of the cities of Eastern and Central Europe. And that's stunning.
This is actually exactly what the ideal Nazi was, blonde, right. Blue-eyed, tall, strong, right. Etc.
He's buying into the idea that Jews are a race, which is, not technically true, and was very prominent in Nazi ideology. And he's buying into this trope about what Jews look like, which, you know, Jews lived in the diaspora. They look all different ways. Clearly, the kids are taller because they're not starving and they're working the land. But the idea that there's some mass mutation when you come and, again, this is a progressive person who says this. People who are of a progressive bent who talk about how un-Jewish the Jews in Palestine look and how they look more like Irish. And I mean, it's very wild because it means that they bought a lot of the tropes, you know, that we're talking about.
The origin story then has this ugliness in it, this despicable Jew, but it also has now the new reborn Jew. Can you talk just a little bit about how that has actually manifested in Israel's internal and external relationships, and also how you see it as playing out? And so that we'll end with you predicting the future a little bit.
That's a big question. I want to start by saying there are a lot of different kinds of Israelis, and it is very dangerous to generalize. But now I'm going to do that anyway, because there is some usefulness in looking at cultural and historical trends. So I think that we can look at the attitude of many Israelis as one that doesn't question Jewish privilege and Jewish power in the face of the occupation of 67 or even what happened in 48, and isn't engaged in any kind of analysis and re-examination of history that I think is a critical thing for countries to be doing, because every country has a origin story that is generally not good or involves oppressing another group. You know, just like in the U.S., with the Black Lives Matter movement and with the civil rights movement. And, you know, there is an active conversation going on about racism and how to build a more just multicultural society, even though we are currently not doing so well. I think that conversation is happening. Whereas in Israel, that conversation isn't happening. And so if Israelis want to be a democracy, they're going to have to face some of these big contradictions, because you can't be a democracy and privilege one group over another. Doesn't work that way. So what we see is a country that feels empowered and doesn't get any cost to killing Palestinian children, bombing Gazans, you know, having its own Palestinian citizens live in a kind of second-class citizenship. It's not seen as a problem. If you look at what Israelis are talking about besides, you know, Netanyahu's indictment, it's not about agonizing about the occupation or the fact that young Israelis go into the army and get transformed in the way armies transform young people. It's not even on the agenda as an issue. And so that means that there's a general buy-in by much of the population that this is the way they got to live, that they're going to mow the lawn periodically in Gaza, that they're going to increase the settlement building and squeeze Palestinians in the West Bank more and more and make their lives more and more difficult, continue the erasure of Palestinian life in East Jerusalem. You know, I get it. Power is very intoxicating. Israelis aren't any worse or better than anyone else. And when I'm using the word Israeli, I'm using the word to mean Jewish Israelis, because, again, even the language doesn't reflect what's going on. I mean, 20% of Israelis are Palestinian. So I'm just acknowledging the inadequacies of our language. I think that if Israeli policies are going to change, they're going to change because of outside pressure, not because there's some, you know, deep moment where Israeli Jews realize that they've been oppressing another people and that it's not a, you know, a long-term solution to their problems. Well, it's not that they're not paying any price, because, you know, having young people serve in the army, I think, is a price. There's more domestic violence. You know, it's a very militarized society. There's more PTSD. You know, soldiers more die from suicide than they do from combat. I mean, there is a price to a society of being an occupier. And many people who are very concerned with the future of Israel feel like Jewish Israelis are losing their souls, given that their task is to live as an occupier in this land where they're not welcomed by the people they're oppressing. So the price has not been very high, and certainly not enough to change the political pathway. And Israeli Jews have moved to the right, so there's not a perception that there's another, a better way to do it. So again, this is not going to change unless there's pressure from the outside.
And so BDS is a form of that pressure from outside.
Right, right. But the boycott movement has opened up a whole conversation that that's really important. Companies have pulled out of the occupied territories, and there's a political cost to performing or doing business in Israel. It's still a very successful economy, and, you know, it exports a huge amount of military weaponry and intelligence and security equipment and knowledge and all that stuff. So it's not that Israel is threatened economically by this, but it's threatened reputationally by this, and that's a powerful force. But, you know, it's light years from changing behavior, because the cost hasn't gotten big enough yet.
Thank you very much
for
doing this. And you should also tell people if they want to be in touch with you.
So I have a website, alicerothchild.com. All my writing's there. I have a calendar of events there. There's a way to contact me through the website, and I'm happy to hear from people. I have written 3 books on the topic. My most recent one is Condition Critical, Life and Death in Israel-Palestine, published by Just World Books. It is a collection of analysis and blog entries. I take you on a trip to the region as a physician and as someone who does human rights work, and then I provide an analytic discussion of the whole situation. So I think it's a useful book for people who want to learn more. Thank you very much. Take care.
You've been listening to Dr. Alice Rothschild talking about Israel's origin story and Zionism's uneasy relationship with anti-Semitism on Tidings on WPKN. You can hear Tidings on the second Wednesday of every month and anytime as podcasts on hazelkahn.com. All Tidings programs are produced by Tony Ernst.